Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Flory, Judge Werke, Judge Bryan. The Honorable James B. Flory presiding.
All right, good morning. Our third and final case on our oral calendar this morning is Villa versus State of Minnesota, court file A210695. I would note that the state has notified the court that they do not wish to participate in oral argument and are resting on our briefing. Therefore, we'll only hear argument today for counsel for the petitioner here. So you'll have 15 minutes for your principal argument, Mr. Burkholz. I would ask that you identify yourself for the record as you begin, and you may proceed when you're ready.
All right. Thank you, court. I guess I could say counsel, but they're not here. It's attorney Jacob Burkholz, representing defendant and appellant Kurt Villa for this appeal. I think this appellate issue, if you've read it, is pretty narrow. Our view is that the district court just in general issued an improper as a matter of law sentencing decision, really restitution, even though it was reserved initially. I don't think the facts are truly in dispute in general terms. And I'm not sure what the state's arguing other than the district court was correct. If the district court was correct, the district court agreed with Mr. Villa and our office's arguments on points one and two. And what am I referencing, of course, is that the fundamental apparent agreement is that restitution was issued in a separate order after sentencing. Therefore, we fall under Minnesota Statute 611A. Make sure I get the right subdivision. Subdivision one, I think B3 or parts one, two, and three. And it perhaps could be a matter of first impression with the concept of what is the true extent. So what happened factually is, of course, the victim's there and says to the court, and I think that's important. There's a couple cases previously that talk about this in the Meridek and Mason v. State. So Mason v. State, neither of which
Meridek was a part of a plea agreement where there was money stolen and an obligation to repay that money. That seems to me to have much more certainty than someone who's been assaulted that says, "Well, I had medical bills of about $45,000." So I think the case is clearly different.
It is for different reasons, Your Honor, and I agree it's a plea agreement issue. But I think the important takeaway from Meridek is that the court highlighted approximate. I mean, obviously, if there's
so as appellant counsel, if at the time of sentencing, then the judge said, "Well, the testimony was about $45,000, which turns out to be more than what it was," you'd be happy with that and ordered it.
I'd be happy with what, if
well,
I were.
The judge at the time of sentencing said, "Well, we already know what the restitution figure is because it was $45,000 and that would have been ordered." To me, that seems more unfair because it's an amount in excess of what was actually decided than not. Would you not have taken issue with that?
Well, this is a unique legal issue, right? I mean, the funny thing is, of course, if they ordered $45,000, it would be a valid order because he didn't contest it. I mean, that's the irony here. I agree with that. But this isn't really about justice. It's about the law. I mean, I don't think anyone likes Mr. Villa. I'm sorry if he's listening, but I know the court doesn't. Very expressly. I was at the probation violation. They sent him to prison. That's a whole nother discussion. But I mean, if you talk about fairness and justice, he had a bad relationship with the PO and they sent him to prison because he didn't do enough work service hours. But that's a whole nother discussion. So obviously that's why Mr. Villa, who gets a notice, that's another irony of the facts here that aren't in the record. Why are we doing it now? Right? Because he got some sort of order from the federal government or the state saying they're going to start collecting on this restitution judgment. That's how it kind of got kicked in. But so in the district court, of course, if you looked at the underlying transcript, didn't even want to hear this hearing and thought we had no basis to even bring this ruling. So she wasn't happy with us. But then when she wrote her order, seemed to agree we had a good case, but then said, well, you know, we think true extent just wasn't met. And the state doesn't just say anything about that either, and neither does case law, and neither does the district court. So this court's left with this kind of predicament of saying, well, what does true extent mean under the statute? And I suppose you could argue it two different ways. I don't want to.
Mr. Perkles, I guess I would look at it slightly differently. I think the question isn't what does true extent mean, but what does the statute mean? And you know, you do have lots of cases where we're discussing the difference between actual and estimated, the difference between something that is specific and itemized and something that is the aggregate. So my question is more about what does the statute require? It says true extent, but it does seem that there are also additional requirements about being specific and itemized and actual under the statute and case law. So it to me, it goes a little bit beyond just the words that you've argued or defined. And I'm looking at, is the testimony at the time of sentencing actual or estimated? Is it specific and itemized, or is it aggregated? And also, is it the true extent?
Well, I wasn't there, right? Just like this court, I don't know, obviously, if there's a statement that says it's 45,000. I'll maybe give a better, my experience, how does it work in the district court? I mean, you know, the district.
Yeah, again, but my question is more about what the law requires. What does the statute require? It seems to me that it requires actual, not estimate. It requires specific and itemized, not aggregate, and also true extent baked into that, whatever that means. And so once we decide what the statute requires, we can then apply it to the transcripts here. So my question was more that first step. What does the statute require in your view?
Well, I think you just have to have, you know, from a restitution basis, it just has to have a line and an amount. You know, if you look at a restitution affidavit ever submitted by the state or the prosecutor, it really just says, here it is and here's an amount. There's no receipts submitted. Restitution nor the statute require receipts. They don't require specific documents. 611A subdivision 1, of course, if what the law requires says, the court or its designee, as I'm quoting, shall obtain the information from the victim in affidavit form or competent evidence, which would be testimony. Competent evidence is testimony. So if the victim is there telling the court, which is Meredith, which says the court has to be aware of 45,000. Now, I would suggest that's actually the best evidence. So if the court had the best possible evidence, which was the victim person itself, and here's what's important in the record, the victim had the true extent known to the person. It was simply estimating and asked for, as Judge Werke noted, a higher amount. Therefore, there's no prejudice here suggesting that the victim didn't know or didn't have adequate information, which would make this case significantly different. So if it says competent evidence, and this is not the prosecutor estimating, this is not the prosecutor going through victim services who didn't have information, this is the victim stating to the court actual competent evidence. And testimony, ironically, the statute doesn't require the victim to testify or even notify the court or the district court. It actually can go through multiple layers of hearsay and make it through a restitution affidavit. So, and they certainly can be estimated. They can be high, they can be low, and the district court and this court will affirm, even if it's remotely estimated. My experience, just like the $400,000 loss, there's no way that a loss occurred exactly $400,000.
No, but that you could see that as a stipulation that the parties made. The loss amount for purposes of restitution is this amount, and they both waive any right to object to anything other than that because it's a plea agreement. But I do appreciate the comments that you're making and kind of the context that you're providing about how common it might be to present an estimate and to rely on that, and then for that to be affirmed.
Right. And I understand there's a bit of the uniqueness here too.
I'm sorry to interrupt. My recollection of the record is that at the time of sentencing, based on the information that the court had, it reserved the issue of restitution and then later ordered it. Did your client or his counsel at the time object to proceeding in that fashion?
Yes, there is an objection in the record in our addendum. Phil Elbert noted that the state in its May 15th filing on the continuance in the lower part of that specifically says we object. They have had a year and a half. That was the underlying appeal that speedy trial rights were violated. He also indicated in that objection, which the court, you know, summarily overruled by granting the extension, said that they had full knowledge of that information. So that objection is noted in the record. And of course, he appealed because restitution hadn't been ordered, so he couldn't have appealed restitution. I saw that objection in the state's letter brief, but he appealed prior to restitution even being ordered. So I don't think you can waive an appellate issue when you're already on appeal from an order that hadn't been issued and which we're arguing was late as a matter of law. you know, another interesting argument I would point out, Your Honor, is that conceptually, I argue that I think the court may have lost jurisdiction in its extension as of May 11th. Even though the extension was dated May 9th, the state asked actually filed its extension May 15th. The district court, as of April 11th, only authorized a 30-day extension. I know expressly this has been litigated in the state district courts and has been granted that if, I haven't seen it on appeal and I don't have a case to give you, but I know that if the state files a late affidavit when the court only authorizes a 30-day reservation, the district court will deny restitution. That's what should have happened in this case. The only irony is that the district court itself, I think, is kind of overruling its own lack of jurisdiction, per se, by granting a late filing when, in essence, it never had jurisdiction to grant the late filing. So when it grants it on the 15th and extends it for another 45 days, then issues the order on August 7th, I think that is a violation of its own sentencing order and when the court doesn't have it. Now, ironically, if you read the statute 611A, it seemingly says, well, subdivision B would come into play at any time and doesn't seemingly seem to prohibit that. But I have expressed concerns about the 30 days and filing by the state 37 days after even a request for an extension is an improper request. So again, back to my point, which I think this case can rest on, if the district court that will meet all the requirements of Balderas, Meredith, and all the other cases of Mason v. State, when the district court has competent evidence before it of the extent from the victim of information, it has to issue it at the sentencing order, or it loses jurisdiction and issues an improper sentencing order and issues an improper restitution order by issuing it later. That's the bottom line here. And because the district court had that full competent knowledge, then it should have fallen on behalf of Mr. Villa to put it in his first appeal. And I think he would have appealed it, but he didn't have that opportunity because of the late filing. So I think it's pretty clear that the victim's losses were known by the district court. In fact, were overestimated. And that's exactly what should have happened, is that it then falls on the defendant to contest it with that evidence. And because he would have and perhaps could have, the court can't cure it by issuing it later. So I'd ask that the court find that true extent means that the district court, and I think that's the interesting question, is whether or not the district court had sufficient competent evidence, to Your Honor, Judge Bryan. You know, that's the key, that the district court has to have it, not the prosecutor, not the other people, and not the failure to disclose. And because the district court had it, because all parties had complete information. And I don't think it's disputed that even the victim had all of his medical bills, because if you look at the time of the assault from the time of the sentencing, there wasn't anything pending with his medical issues. It would be complete speculation and inconsistent with the record that the victim would have been being treated still, or like if a defendant pled guilty immediately and the person was still in the hospital, I could see that that might not be a situation that would apply. But this is somewhere where the victim and all the victim services in the state and the prosecutor and had provided that information to the district court at the time of sentencing. So this is one of those cases where how can you then come back and say, well, we'll issue it basically at any time we want? Because what's the reciprocal argument here? If this court says, well, it's close enough, meaning we didn't know the true extent until we had receipts, that would put some insurmountable burden and would allow the state and provide no protection for defendants and allow the state at any time to seek a restitution order. Really, subdivision B3 doesn't mean anything. Because if the court has the full request from the victim of ascertainable damages, what's preventing the district court from issuing a restitution order at any time? And why couldn't it issue an amended order? Why couldn't then this victim come back now and say, well, actually, I have more complications. I want another 100,000. And then rest on this saying, well, that's the true extent. We'll extend it 2 years, 3 years. And that's the real concern here for this court when it issues an order for other people to follow, meaning law for Minnesota is, well, guess what? If you don't have the receipt, then you can do it at any time. And I think that's the real concern here, because if you look at the language of the statute, it says may amend or issue an order of restitution after sentencing or disposition. That broad reading of the language would open up Pandora's box for restitution. And that's the extreme concern here, not for Mr. Villa specifically, but for any other case in the future, because true extent, if construed exceptionally narrowly, meaning must provide receipts and documentation, then we think it would be an unreasonable interpretation. So we'd ask that the court vacate restitution and side with the appellant. I see I only have 30 seconds. Any questions?
Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Burkholz. We will then take the matter under advisement and we'll issue a decision in the matter within the statutory timeframe.